chart, but just the way it is these days. I want to give you an idea how we're going to proceed through the agenda. We will hear the public hearing on House Bill 2285. I think with respect to the Dash 3 amendments only, the Dash 2 amendments we will have to set over to the first available time next week because we do not have time this morning to do everything. After that, we have 9 Senate bills, and House session begins at 11. Of those 9 House bills, we will start with Senate Bill 921A and then follow the rest of the list in order. I hope you can keep the time considerations in order on House Bill 2285. We have 12 witnesses. I anticipate that will take some time. We have been distributed and have seen the staff report, and we've seen the Dash 3 amendments. I think it's a very narrow but yet very relevant issue. I hope you can keep your testimony focused on that and give us some opportunity to hear you all as briefly as we can. We will give your matter complete consideration nonetheless. So with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2285. Council, tell us about this bill.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2285, specifically the Dash 3 amendments, prohibit an inquiry into the purposes for which an administrative law judge disqualifies himself or herself from a contested case. It also provides that disqualification by an ALJ is not official misconduct, incompetence, inefficiency, indolence, malfeasance, or other unfitness to render effective service. And it provides that disqualification may not be the basis for a disciplinary action or criterion in the performance evaluation of the ALJ.
Before we start, let me just sort of make a slight correction. In reviewing the witness sign-up sheet for 2285, I note that a lot of the witnesses are here on the Dash 2 amendments, which will not be heard this morning. So that will cut down the witness list quite considerably. I want to call up, therefore, the proponents of Dash 3 amendments for House Bill 2285. And some of you, I'm going to call names. I don't know whether you're here on the Dash 2 or the Dash 3s, but again, I'm calling people for the Dash 3 amendments. I have a Thomas Doyle. Are you here? Are you on the Dash 2 or the Dash 3 amendments?
Sure, I'm here on the Dash 2 amendments, and so
that's going to be set over then.
Absolutely.
And we'll give you a time on that. It'll be the earliest
much.
Time we can. All right, I have a I'll call Kevin Mannix. I know we've talked about this, so you know he's here on the Dash 3. Vance Day.
I don't know what she's on.
And those are the two that I have as proponents. If I've missed anyone, we'll pick it up in the next panel. Gentlemen, welcome to the subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Vance Day. I am the one who asked for this hearing and discussed this with the Speaker's office. Let me give you just a brief bit of history with regard to these Dash 3 amendments and why they come before you. There was a petition that was filed with the with the Workers' Compensation Board in September of this past year. It specifically requested that ALJs not be required to discuss or tell why they are recusing themselves. You're probably familiar with, of course, judges who may come to the bench and there are people who they know in front of them, or they have some conflict or some bias or some reason that they, the judge, cannot be biased to the litigants. The Oregon State Bar and the section, Workers' Compensation section, many attorneys requested that this rule be put into effect and that they amend OAR 438 to do such. That petition was denied, so we bring this matter before you. This matter is critical for the independence of judges. If management is allowed to require a judge to discuss even confidential matters, which are the basis of their decision to recuse themselves, it has a chilling effect on the ability of a judge to be impartial. Let me give you a brief example. If a judge has litigants before them that they feel they cannot be biased toward, but know that if they recuse themselves, they will then be questioned by the presiding judge as to the reason, and specifically requested to give the reasons to that judge. That judge may choose not to recuse themselves and therefore be in a position where they cannot be unbiased toward the litigants. Therefore, the long-standing policy and the tradition that has been in this nation, frankly, for the last 200 years, that judges will not be asked their thought processes on why they recuse themselves, is codified in this bill. I would ask that this petition and the evidence related to it be entered into the record. I don't make copies for you because it's quite long, so if that could be done, I'll set that here, and I ask that it...
Could you summarize what's in that exhibit, counsel?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman?
Could you summarize what is in that document? I don't want you to read it word for word.
No, we don't want you to have to labor through this,
Mr.
Chairman. I
will disqualify you without reason.
This is the record and the letters from both sides of the Bar Association, the claimant side and the employer side, requesting that this rule be made into the OARs, be amended. It's the same rule that we asked, that we're asking for you to codify at this point in time. Just by way of background, I'm a claimant's attorney. I represent exclusively injured workers and injured parties. I'm a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, ATLA. I hope that doesn't scare anybody. I have practiced here in Oregon for nearly 15 years. I've tried over 350 cases. This is an important issue. One more point. It is unfortunate, but what has essentially happened is that we have the Workers' Compensation Board. I have a letter here, September 3rd, 2004, to a Michael Bostwick. It's in this packet. And it's from Maureen Bach, the chair of the Workers' Compensation Board. And to summarize, she says here that the presiding ALJ does not require details underlying the reason for recusal. The presiding ALJ simply needs to know, in general terms, that the ALJ has a potential bias conflict with someone connected to the case so he can address as needed future case docketing procedures and implications. I have a letter dated the same day from the presiding ALJ to a specific judge. In that letter, September 3rd, 2004, John McCullough states, I pressed you for the specific reason, and then goes on through the letter telling the judge that the judge will tell him what the specific reason for the recusal is, finally saying at the end, accordingly, I am directing you to provide a clear, specific reason or reasons why you recused yourself. Your failure to provide that answer in writing by 5 p.m. on September 30th, 2004 will be considered insubordination and may result in discipline up to and including dismissal. Now, if that doesn't cause a chilling effect to run through our ALJ core, I cannot imagine anything that would. Unfortunately, ALJ McCullough comes back in November 18th, 2004, and states in a letter to Roger Pearson, it's in this packet, to summarize that he won't be making specific inquiries. It's just simply a matter that involves managing the ALJs, and he will only ask general terms. To quote, the presiding ALJ simply needs to know in general terms that the ALJ has a potential bias conflict. What I submit to you, unfortunately, is that we have a public statement of general terms, but a private act of specific terms, which causes ALJs to have to let the judge know the specific terms. So we ask that you consider this bill appropriately.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Mannix?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Kevin Mannix, attorney in private practice here in Salem. I'm not here wearing my other hat, which is chairman of the Republican Party. I'm here as Citizen Mannix, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify to the Dash 3 amendments to this bill. I will mention that I testified at length before the Hearings Division Hearings Officer, not ALJ as far as I'm concerned. They were holding a hearing about comment, public comment on a proposed rule. And you can find my eloquent, if I may say so, I just read it this morning, testimony beginning at page 20 of that record, which has been made part of the record in this case, so I won't go over that. But let me put this into global context. The administrative law judges and workers' compensation are the closest thing to real judges that we have in administrative practice in the state. They are not holding hearings to gather evidence for someone else to make a decision. They are not usually dealing with cases which involve the state up against the citizen where the state's trying to make a decision about what the state ought to do. They are doing what judges traditionally do in civil actions in circuit court. They are hearing cases involving one party against another party. Sometimes it's the state because the state can be an employer, but this is employer versus worker. It may be employer through claims administrator, employer through insurer, but it's employer versus worker. It's adjudication of real cases involving real people, involving real money, and we want judges who will be as independent as possible in making those decisions. Now, I've been heavily involved in workers' compensation legislation over the years, and I fought for the name change to administrative law judge because when we were saying there were hearings referees, it was not a reflection of what they were really doing. And there are some times that we use the term administrative law judge when we ought not to, because I think they really are hearings officers in some cases, gathering evidence, making recommendations, but not deciding cases. We have real judges here deciding cases. Now, what is the recusal issue all about? It's ultimately about creating an atmosphere which is most conducive to fairness to the parties. There are times when a judge may be very open about recusal. I'm married to the claimant. I'm married to the employer. Well, you know, that's a pretty obvious thing. You shouldn't have gotten the case in the first place. There are other times when the judge may have very private reasons for deciding to recuse himself or herself and may not want to reveal those reasons, but may understand inside that that person is not fully being fair or might not fully be fair. In my other testimony, I indicated, for example, you may start going through the record in a case. And these ALJs are lawyers. And say you run across a report from somebody in that record that you represented when you were an attorney. And in the course of that representation, you learned some things about that person that affected your judgment about that person in a negative way, all as part of attorney-client privilege. And you see that document and you think, oh, golly, I better recuse myself from this case because there's some things I know outside this record that affect my judgment, and someone else ought to be independently evaluating this case. Should you have to tell someone about what came down in that case as to why you recused yourself? Or, as I indicated in my other testimony, you could move from very serious to the sublime to the silly. What if you're judging a case that's been assigned to you and you're reviewing the record and something political happens involving one of the advocates and you're very offended by the position that advocate took, so offended you think it might affect your reading of the record and your handling of the decision making? You may be embarrassed about that. You may not want to admit that to anybody, but you may, within yourself, be willing to say, gee, I'm not really going to be fair in this case because I'm so angry or so happy about something this person has done. There are so many things that can come up, and all we want is a process where the judge is encouraged to step back and not decide a case if the judge has any reason to believe the judge will not be completely fair to the parties. Now, the administrators are all going to come in and say, well, this is a management issue. Yeah, it's a management issue. And I don't want the ALJs being managed when it comes to fairness. Not when it's my client against his client and we're there as advocates. We do not want them to be managed. And if they have management issues with ALJs about productivity, there are plenty of standards that can be applied. I was an ALJ for 3 years. I know about the monthly reports. How many hearings have you held? How many miles have you traveled? How many decisions have you issued? And if you're lagging, it'll show up. That's an objective standard. But not, please, a management standard of saying, tell me why you pulled out of that case. They should not be allowed to do that, and I understand Management Labor Advisory Committee is not in support of this bill. That's too bad. But this is a matter of public policy that rises above the power interest within workers' compensation, which is management and labor. It rises above the bureaucracy of workers' compensation. It is a public policy decision that is squarely in front of this committee, and you have an opportunity to say, we want fairness in this process. We don't want special interests having a thumb on the scale, and we don't want management having its fist on the scale. We want administrative law judges who can be fully fair and unbiased. This is a nice piece of legislation to shove us a little further in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Does the committee have questions of the witnesses? Yes, Representative.
Mr. Maddox, when a judge is asked has recused himself and is asked why, how much detail does he have to go into at that time? Couldn't he give a descriptive phrase without going into detail that would reveal a bias?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, in fact, my concern is that you even open the door at all. Once you have said that some inquiry can be made, you've walked into a room. And my view is don't go there, because how far do you get to go? Does the judge have to give some general statement of the type of bias that may exist? Is that going to be satisfactory? My view is once you let someone start inquiring, how far do they go in terms of their inquiry about what your views may be, what you knew about that person that you read the report from in the file? And my view is you shouldn't go there at all. Now, again, I've heard the arguments, well, this affects productivity because if someone recuses himself or herself too much, they're not being productive. Well, darn it. If they're recusing themselves too much, then they're not holding enough hearings and they're not issuing enough decisions, or maybe they're not traveling enough miles. There are plenty of objective standards about productivity without having to open that door and to go into a dark room and you don't know what's in there.
Further questions from the committee? Gentlemen, what about the middle ground? Suppose we had a bill that said that the disclosure was discretionary with the judge rather than mandatory, or rather than no, you shall not do that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I understand the purpose of that, and it allows, therefore, the judge to give the reason if they feel comfortable. I personally feel that would still be walking into the room that Mr. Mannix talked about. And the reason is because there's pressure. If the presiding judge comes to that ALJ and says, well, you know, you have discretion and you really need to exercise that discretion, it allows that pressure to be brought to bear. The ALJ already has that discretion. There's no rule that says they cannot disclose,
mm-hmm.
and they clearly can at any point in time. But to walk into that room and allow that inquiry to be made has that chilling effect.
What is the extent of the, is it the chief administrative law judge, will have the term right?
Presiding.
Presiding, that's right. What is his or her authority to require the administrative law judges to disclose right now? Is there an administrative rule? Is it a matter of policy? Is it an unwritten rule that frequently haunts our courts? What's his or her source of authority?
Well, John McCullough is here, and I believe he will be next to testify. He may be able to give you some specific answers to that. My understanding is that he has, there is a policy that was put forth in 1998-1999 that said, I think it's discretionary. He'll have to comment on that. But our concern is like his letter to the ALJ on September 3rd, specifics, and if you fail to provide those specifics, you'll be disciplined for insubordination up into including dismissal. That causes the Bar Association, at least the practitioner's, fear.
I understand, but my point is, if it's a policy, is it a written policy we can look at, or is this something that the presiding judge can make up, or is it something that's formulated through a process? Where do we get this?
Well, we tried to amend the process through the OAR in this petition that we're submitting to you as exhibit, and it was denied.
And so my general impression,
based upon what I have experienced, and by the way, out of the 350-plus cases I've tried, I've had one judge recuse themselves on one occasion. It's very, very rare.
Now, but right now, the source of that authority is a policy of the administrative law judge.
Yes, whatever. The Workers' Compensation Board.
Now, is it just the Workers' Comp Board, or is it the charge of all administrative law judges?
Just the Workers' Compensation Board, and this applies to the Workers' Compensation Board in that
sense. And the statute amendment then does not apply overall to all agencies, just to the Workers' Comp Board?
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, if I may, this is simply in the context of the Workers' Compensation Board, which selects the presiding administrative law judge, which runs the hearings division of the Workers' Compensation Board. And that is a separate operation from, for instance, the Central Hearings Agency and these other operations that we have in state government. And the source of the authority, I suppose the other witnesses will talk to you about it, but right now I think it's simply considered part of the management authority to say, explain yourself. Be curious. We wanted the rules amended. We went through that process to ask for a rule amendment that clearly made it clear that a judge did not have to disclose the reason for recusal. That's been refused by the management authorities, and this allows the greater management body of the Legislative Assembly to decide whether they think it's good public policy.
Okay, last question. Should this be expanded to include all agencies? Or just do you feel comfortable just leaving the dash threes to control the process within the workers' compensation system?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I would say that this is a good place to start. The Workers' Compensation Board Hearings Division has always been, in the last 20 years at least, the closest thing to an independent decision-making division where ALJs make final decisions based on the presentations made to them, and then if someone wants to challenge it, they literally have to appeal to the board, seek board review. Other agencies operate so differently. Sometimes the ALJs make recommended decisions, etc. I wouldn't want to delve into those areas because I think they raise other public policy considerations. But in this area, we can be certain of the need for independent administrative law judges. It would be tougher to go into other arenas, and you'd certainly want to go through a long-term fact-finding process to see how it would apply elsewhere. Here you've had the benefit of a full public hearing process as to a proposed rule, which was negated by management, and so the legislature could focus on this. And if it works well here, which it should, then we might consider applying it elsewhere.
Okay, thank you. Further questions from the committee? Okay, there are none. You're excused at least temporarily. Thank you for your participation. Are there any other proponents of the Dash 3 amendments that would like to speak at this point? This is a Dash 3 amendments only. Please come forward then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lane Barlow, representing Oregon Men's Association. On the Dash 3 amendments, just a couple of quick comments. First of all, as the two gentlemen previously stated, this is recusal, not disqualification. Disqualification is something you do to a hearings officer. Recusal is something they do for themselves. Secondly, and you touched on this in your comments before, this whole section in the Dash 3 that's in bold should be copied into ORS 183.645 and apply to all hearings officers and administrative law judges. There is no similar process or, how should I put it, what the gentleman said before, if a hearings officer is going to recuse themselves, they shouldn't have to explain it to anybody and keep the process clean. And even though they are not judges and strictly in the administrative process, they should be able to do that also. And all further comments we'll reserve for supplemental testimony and for the next hearings.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Barlow. Are there questions from the committee? Seeing none, then thank you very much. Anyone else wishing to testify that's a proponent of the Dash 3 amendments? Okay, seeing none, I'll call the next panel, John McCulloch, Maureen Bach. You want to come forward, please? Do I have anyone else in the audience that's either neutral or against the Dash 3 amendments? Just raise your hand. Then why don't you come up to the witness stand, please? All right, you may proceed in any manner you wish.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman. My name is Maureen Bach. I'm the chair of the Workers' Compensation Board. The board is neutral on this bill and the Dash 3 amendments. I want to kind of put this in context. You heard that the petition was denied, which is true. That was done by board action. because the board did not have sufficient time to consider the petition before it proceeded. Having said that, the board did convene a work group, which is actually had members from both sides of the bar on it, and they have been working on a rule that will be considered by the entire board at a board meeting at the end of June. So while you heard that the petition was denied, I think I need to put it in context that the entire board did proceed with consideration of the rural petition through a work group that was convened. As the board chair, I have three divisions, three executive managers. One is the presiding administrative law judge who oversees the hearings division. That division is a fairly large organization. It consists of about 29 administrative law judges and a number of support staff. We conduct hearings all over the state. And generally, what we try to do with the 10,000 requests for hearing we get every year is schedule those efficiently. And that means that we would like to know when we're scheduling whether or not one of our administrative law judges has a conflict with an attorney or a party prior to scheduling, so we can schedule those hearings efficiently and effectively. When something does come up in the context of a hearing and an administrative law judge recuses him or herself, we would like to know to whom the conflict runs and whether it's a one-time conflict or an ongoing conflict. If it's an ongoing conflict, we can put that in our database and keep from scheduling hearings with that at ALJ if that party is a party to the case. So that is our interest in asking for the information that we ask for. I don't want to take up too much of your time. The presiding administrative law judge, John McCullough, is here with me today, and he can certainly address any questions that you might have. But I'm happy to take questions if you have any.
Thank you. Mr. McCullough?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John McCullough. I'm the presiding administrative law judge for the Workers' Compensation Board's Hearings Division. I've been in that position for a little over 9 years. Prior to that, I was a trial administrative law judge for 17 years with the board, so I think I have some experience in these matters. And I guess, well, first of all, I would reiterate what Chair Baca said. The agency is neutral on this bill. We've provided a committee with a bill analysis, which we think raises the implications of what the bill language would have. In particular, I would note on the second page of the analysis, the ultimate implication of this is that if a particular ALJ chose for whatever reason to not complete or even case assignment a hearing in an order that ultimately would have to be issued, there is no one, not the presiding ALJ, not the chair of the board, not ultimately the governor, who is the person who appoints the board chair, no one to whom that ALJ would be accountable for not completing that case assignment. That, to us, is one implication of this bill. The other potential implication is, as Chair Bach indicated, the concern that the agency has and when these occasions arise involving a potential conflict and a need for an ALJ to recuse themselves is to simply know whether there is a conflict with a party or one of the attorneys, so that if a case involving that party or more likely the attorney comes up before the board in the future, which certainly happens with the attorneys who practice before us frequently, we will know that there is a conflict and do what we can do to make sure the ALJ doesn't get scheduled, you know, with that party or attorney on another case so that the same recusal problem doesn't come up. Particularly if that sort of problem comes up at the last minute, case has been scheduled because the agency didn't know about a conflict, and conflict emerges shortly before the date of the hearing. Hearing has to be postponed in that situation sometimes. Parties then have to wait for getting their hearing rescheduled. That's an inefficiency to the parties that we would like to avoid. The only other thing I would add, there was a reference to a letter that I authored back in September involving a specific situation involving a conflict, and I would just like to clarify for the record that all that was being asked at that time through a letter and through a subsequent meeting was that the ALJ in question provide a general idea, and the letter may have said specific. That's true. I don't have the letter in front of me. But what was being sought was simply the whether a conflict existed in that particular case involving a party, a witness, or an attorney, so that I would know to be able to advise docketing not to reschedule future cases for that ALJ with that particular party or attorney. That information was being was provided subsequently to me, and it was accepted as adequate. And that is all that I would submit that the presiding ALJ, whether it's me or any future presiding ALJ, would need to know about in terms of managing our docketing function in the hearings division. We don't need to know the details of why the ALJ felt that he or she could not pursue the case. It's simply what kind of conflict is it so we can deal with it. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions if any of the members or the chair have any specific questions.
Thank you. Next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI, and here today to oppose the Dash 3 amendments. There's a couple of reasons. The primary reason is that we have just celebrated our 15th year of workers' comp reform, early May. I can't remember now if it was May 7th or May 9th, but that's when the Mahonia Hall Senate Bill 1197 had a special session. It's been 15 years since then. During that time, we have successfully implemented a advisory committee to the legislature made up of members of the community for which workers' comp system is designed for. It's designed for the employers and the employees of Oregon. And the Management Labor Advisory Committee is made up of equal representation of representatives from the employer community and labor community. And I don't recall that this bill, when it was Senate Bill 930, was ever brought before the Management Labor Advisory Committee by its proponents. Now, there were two meetings in which I was absent, and it could have occurred at that time, but I don't recall that Management Labor Committees ever had a presentation on what was Senate Bill 930. And so number one is that we have for 15 years successfully relied on the advice and guidance and recommendations of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and we think that's an appropriate body to look at a bill such as this, the Dash 3 amendments. Secondly, as the representatives of the Workers' Comp Board have indicated, on any hearing you have four parties. You have the claimant's attorney, the employer, and the employer's attorney. And if you're going to have somebody recusing themselves from the case, when you're setting up the number of hearings that are scheduled, it in order to get things done in a timely fashion, you need to know up front if there's going to be issues. Is it the employer? Is it the defense attorney? Is it the claimant's attorney? Does it happen to be the claimant? What's the reason that this ALJ can't do that hearing, so that when you schedule in the future, you don't book a hearing with that same ALJ who still has that same issue with whichever. Eventually, I'm assuming you'd come up with a pattern and be able to identify which party it might be, but it's not a very efficient way to run a hearings division. And so for those reasons, we would ask that you reject the Dash 3 amendments.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions of the by the committee to the panel? Yes, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, like some other members of the committee, I'm a little baffled as to why this issue seems to have evolved to the point where it's involving a proposed change to statute. Is there a particular case or a particular ALJ that this gives rise to this issue, or is it really a policy issue for how the ALJs for workers' comp ought to be conducting themselves? I'll offer that to Mr. McCulloch or Ms. Bach.
Representative McPherson and members of the committee, I really don't know what the impetus of this was. We have 29 administrative law judges. Most of them have had a recusal at some point in their career. Most of them offer that up. If it's a one-time issue, say they go through the record and they discover that they've treated with a physician the case, they bring that to the presiding and say, please reschedule this with someone else. I have a conflict, you know, because of this doctor-patient relationship that I had with the doctor. and then the presiding will reschedule that case. Or it, when we have new ALJs come in, say from a practice, they will typically not be scheduled to hear cases from that law firm for a period of time. So the inventory with which they might be familiar in a advocate role doesn't come before them. And we have a docketing person who keeps track of those things when the presiding brings those forward. So we aren't setting those cases with that person. So I believe this is an anomaly, but certainly the advocates of the bill could probably speak to that. I also would like to note that we have administrative law judge representation on the advisory group that is working on this petition, and which will be considered at the end of June.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee of the panel? Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you. Ms. Trussell, you indicate that you are in opposition to these Dash 3 amendments. Now, your opposition is based on needing to know how a matter can be resolved in the most expeditious manner, and the parties involved would not be, you need to know that there's a perhaps a conflict or a personal matter, but are you suggesting that you need to know the specific reason for a recusal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, no. And actually, it wouldn't be me as the employer anyway. It's me as them for scheduling. And as far as I'm concerned, no, you don't need to know the detail. But you have to, I think, it's reasonable to know who's the party. And as it's been pointed out a couple of times during both the proponents and the board's presentation, you know, maybe it's one of the medical providers that there's an issue with. But just some sort where you can identify so that when you're doing scheduling, you don't end up scheduling it with somebody who's going to end up having to recuse himself when he could have been aware of that after their last recusal if he'd been made aware of what the reason for the recusal was. And when I say reason, I'm talking about is it an individual or is it the company or whatever, so that we know when that name appears, we shouldn't probably schedule that ALJ with that case.
Could I supplement? Mr. Chair, would it be all right for me to answer that question also?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I would echo what Ms. Trussell said and make reference to, I was kindly handed a copy of one of the earlier witnesses of the letter that was referred to by that witness that I authored in September. The phrase specific reason and clear specific reason was used by me. The intent then and now and at any time behind that phrase specific reason is simply, is there a conflict with an attorney? Is there a conflict with a party? Or is it a witness? That's the specificity that I had in mind and would have in mind. I don't need to know why the conflict exists. If there was some personal thing that happened, that really isn't our concern. But specific reason simply means who was it? I mean, is it a lawyer that you're going to appear in front of again? Or is it a party, an employer, for example, self-insured employer or insurer, that's going to come through our system on multiple occasions in the future? You know, who is that entity, just so we can make sure that the conflict, hopefully, will not come up in the future with the docketing implications and possible hearing postponement implications that it would carry. That's what the intent behind specific reason is. Details are not, and in this particular case that generated this letter, ultimately the reason given was that kind of a specific term. It was an individual, a party. That was all that was needed. That was accepted. And there was no need to go into any details.
Mr. McCulloch, yes. In the letter of September 3, 2004 that you've just obviously taken a look at, the sentence on the first page where you do use the phrase pressed you for specific reason, you begin that sentence by saying you declined to provide a reason, stating only that you thought your impartiality might reasonably be questioned. Now, if you have an administrative law judge telling you that they think that there's a conflict or that their impartiality would be impaired, you seem to be pressing for the specific detail.
Well, I can only tell you what I had in mind and what that phrase means to me, Representative Flores, and that is specific impartiality reasonably may be questioned. The specific reason is, why is it by the employer, by the attorney for the claimant, the attorney for the employer, the insurer? You know, that's the need. That's the reason. What's the basis why the impartiality may be questioned? You know, what's the source of the conflict? If there's some, again, something that's happened, transpired between the ALJ and that party or attorney, I don't need to know about that. And that's not what was being asked for in this case, nor would it be asked for in any other case.
You may.
Thank you, Mr. McCulloch. I'm just questioning that you seem to focus on using, with repetition, the specific reason and the clear and specific reason, and yet you do not say or follow up in your letter requesting the clear and specific reason that be directed to whether or not it is against an attorney or against a party or against another entity or an individual. So I'm curious as far as what you perhaps thought you were communicating and what was indeed conveyed, because this seems to be a clear indication that you are asking for some specific reason.
Well, all due respect, that's not what the intent of that phrasing was from me. I was not looking for details as to what the underlying conflict was, what the problem was, if any, that the individual had with the whether it was the party. At that time, I didn't know whether we were talking about a conflict with a party or a witness or an attorney. That was what was underlying specific reason. Clear to me means, who is it, as opposed to not knowing who it is. So I can only tell you that's what I had in mind, and that's what ultimately was given, and that's what was accepted as adequate when the response finally was forthcoming in this particular instance.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bach, it's good to see you again. And John, Mr. Chair, I've had the opportunity to work with both of these people and hold them in the highest esteem. And so it is with that in mind that I ask you, if we were to pass this, would it cause a backlog and really affect the number of cases you could see in a specific or schedule in a specific time period?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, that is the potential. As you may or may not be aware, there is a House bill, number 2717, that attempts to address an inventory of postponed cases. One of the things that leads to postponements and to cases being rescheduled is if someone at the last minute determines that they have a conflict. And then that workload has to be assigned to someone else. That's a new set that can't be set with that administrative law judge if the work is assigned to someone else. So, yes, there is a potential for delaying and postponing work. It all kind of builds up.
The volume, Representative Garrard, would obviously depend upon how many instances where you have recusals, and historically there aren't very many. Individual ALJ recusals. The conflicts come up from time to time, but we're not talking about a large volume of instances like that, at least not based on the past. And there's no reason to think that would happen in the future. In terms of, on a weekly basis, ALJs having conflicts that result in these sorts of situations. I don't think we're talking about that kind of volume at all.
Mr. Chair, the other thing that I, and members of the committee, the other thing I would add is you need to keep in mind that we are looking at roughly 10,000 requests for hearing every year being scheduled with our 29 administrative law judges. And the more we know about whether or not they have conflicts at the front end, the more efficiently we can schedule those cases. And so that is the reason that we ask for our ALJs to let us know timely if it is a one-time conflict or an ongoing conflict, and to whom the conflict runs.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bach, and I'm sorry if it was indicated earlier, you have approximately 10,000 workers' comp cases that you hear a year, 29 administrative law judges, and did you indicate how many matters of dealing with recusal have been brought forward or to your attention?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Flores, members of the committee, we set 10,000 requests for hearing. We hear about 2,000 to 3,000 cases a year. Recusals do tend to be fairly rare, I would say. Most of them are dealt with very informally through, you know, someone going through a record and realizing that one of the witnesses or something is someone that they have a relationship with, in which case they bring that to the presiding and it's assigned to another case. They usually switch cases in that case. What we do if someone comes out of a law practice is we then have a table when we're setting cases the first instance where we can not set those individuals from that law firm or those parties with that ALJ. We can set them with one of the other 28 administrative law judges. So that's why we ask at the front end. And most of the ALJs let us know, you know, I had a personal relationship with X and, I, you know, don't set me with those people. That's between the presiding, the docketing person, the administrative law judge. That is not something that the rest of us care to know about, quite frankly.
Thank you.
Last follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Dash 3 amendments that you're talking about here and we'll be working through with your work group are primarily to set the table for perhaps a preemptive measure and to better manage cases in the event there were something that were brought to, were matters that were brought to your attention. Do I understand correctly?
Representative Flores, we already have that in place. We already have a conflict table, is what we call it, that basically in our computer system flags cases. So an administrative law judge who has a conflict, let's say with your firm, if you had one, would not be scheduled to hear your cases. So that already exists. And so that's just one of the things that we've asked our administrative law judges to provide us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions? If not, thank you for your participation, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2285.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I said we would proceed next to Senate Bill 921. We also have another, because we have a witness that has a time problem, we also have a witness with a time problem in Senate Bill 2324A. Senator Walker, so what I'll do is open the public hearing on the latter bill first, so I'm opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 324A and call.
Mr. Chairman, I understand there's a medical emergency, so if you would take 921 first and then I'll wait.
Okay. That's fine. Then I'll rescind the opening of the public hearing on Senate Bill 324A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 921A. And for the remaining people here, we're starting our Senate bills. We have nine. I'd like to get out in an hour. So please keep that in mind with your testimony. It's our goal to get as many Senate bills to the full committee as we can to accommodate the Senate and accommodate the process. We have a problem that the subcommittee will not be in operation next Monday, so there's a Memorial Day holiday. So we're trying to get a push to assist the Senate with their bills. So you may introduce yourself and testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 921 today and accommodating our schedule for one of our attorneys to testify on this bill. Briefly, Senate Bill 921 is a bill that cleans up some procedures for adoption proceedings. This is the case of an adoption done in done privately. You've heard several bills this session regarding termination of parental rights by the state, and that would be in a juvenile court proceeding. This is in family court because there's a private adoption. But this, if the procedure is similar in that you're terminating the parental rights of the parent and going forward with an adoption privately. But there's still notice requirements to make sure that any parents who have not already consented to the adoption would also either consent or there's reason to dispense with that consent because there's been abuse or neglect or that parent is no longer a part of the child's life. So this bill requires notice, but it's cleaning up the procedure. Right now, there's an archaic system of providing notice, and it's called a citation procedure. So this bill takes that out and makes the standard notice to these parents. There's also a right to court-appointed counsel when your rights as a parent are being terminated, and so this bill puts in statute that right that was noticed in a Supreme Court opinion. It's just never been codified that parents do have a right, even in private adoption cases. Lastly, it makes the procedure similar to the termination of parental rights cases in that if the parent does not show up or doesn't make an objection or notes their consent, the proceeding can move it along, and so it provides for procedure for the court to follow. There are two amendments to this bill, and I'll just briefly hit them. The dash ones allow for publication, posting of notice by the if the court allows. For both publication and posting, a court has to allow that type of service. I mean, it's you know that you can't find the parent, and you still need to try to attempt to provide notice. The bill is ambiguous regarding posting, and so this amendment would particularly allow posting if a court allowed that method. It's a cost savings method rather than publication in a newspaper. The dash two amendments are a cleanup measure from the Public Defense Services, and it simply cleans up when a court can provide substituted counsel when appointed counsel is made. And Attorney Scott Adams has participated on this work group. He's an adoption attorney who is advocating strongly for the Dash 1 amendments as well as the bill.
Thank you. Let me do something that I omitted. I did not have counsel explain the bill, so I'd like to have him interject that now and tell us what amendments are relevant to the proceedings this morning. Counsel?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I think Ms. Johnson more than adequately summarized the contents of the bill. I would only clarify that the amendments, which she also accurately described, are actually the dash A2 amendment that has to do with the posting issue, and the dash A3 amendment, which has to do with making the consistent substitution of appointed counsel change. Otherwise, this is basically the measure that codifies the Oregon Supreme Court case of Zockert v. Fanning, and everything else that Ms. Johnson said, I think, is objective and accurate.
Thank you.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Adams, and as Ms. Johnson said, I'm an adoption attorney. My practice is about 80% adoption work. I tell most of my clients it's pretty much all I do anymore. I've been involved with this bill from the very beginning because it's something I deal with every day and my clients deal with every day. And I think it's important to realize that this bill does have basically two parts. It provides significantly more notice in the initial paperwork that's being sent to a parent whose rights are being sought to be terminated. And in addition to providing all of that additional notice, it also addresses how we can serve that information. Previously, all you had to do under the citation order system was send them a one piece of paper that said, show up or your rights are going to be terminated, or show up and tell us why this adoption shouldn't happen. It gave no detail. It didn't tell them of their rights. It didn't give them any other information that every other civil case that we deal with, even other family law matters, we have to give them a summons that says you have a certain amount of time to show up, you can file an answer, here's where you file an answer. None of that information was provided in the citation and order system. And in fact, most of the practitioners out there believe that because 109.330 as it existed ordered us to use the citation and order system, we weren't even allowed to provide that additional information if we wanted to. So this gives potential parents whose rights would be terminated significantly more information up front. The downside of that, if you will, to an adoption attorney like myself who has to provide that notice is if I have to provide it by publication, which previously 330 only allowed for either personal service or publication, if I had to provide it by publication, now instead of publishing one page, I'm having to publish four or five pages of information. And
clearly that could get extremely costly. My citation, I've often had be over $500 to publish the one page. If I had to publish four or five pages, and the newspapers don't do it based on a legal notice, they do it based on inches. It could have made the publication itself be over $2,000 or $2,500. What this bill has done is it has said, look, serving somebody with an adoption matter is just like serving them with any other matters, and ORCP 7 tells you how you can do that. The publication posting amendment comes about because in the bill, instead of just saying, if we serve them under 7D, or as allowed under 7D, then you're good and they've got 30 days to answer. Unfortunately, the bill said, if you serve them by publication under 7D, and it gave the inference that the other methods under 7D6 aren't available then, because it only said by publication. So what we're asking for in the posting is to clarify that posting is also another option available by 7D if the judge allows it, after you've given specific reasons to the judge. And now I can post in the appropriate public place all four or five or six pages instead of having to pay for them to be published in the court newspaper or whatever the local newspaper is. It's not by any means an attempt to not give that information. In fact, we still have to do the service by mail or personal or the other methods provided by 7 before we could get a court order not to do it. The practical side of it is, if we didn't have the allowance of the amendment, there would be people out there. Some of my clients, especially in a step-parent adoption case, have a situation where a biological mother or father has been absent for 5 years, sometimes more. We can't find them. That's why we need to use service by another method. And if we didn't have that option and it was going to cost them $2,500 to publish, that child would continue to go on without having a legal parent. The step parent would not be able to adopt them because we couldn't affect service. And I'm happy to provide any answers to practical sides of it or specifics about the amendments that I can.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. I had one other witness signed up, and I think that was Ingrid Swenson. Are you here? There you are. Please come forward. Well, keep in mind there's no opposition, at least on the witness list, to this bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ingrid Swenson. I'm with the Office of Public Defense Services, and both the prior witnesses have indicated that the A3 amendments address an oversight from the last legislative session with respect to substitution of counsel. Basically, in the last session in House Bill 2074, the legislature indicated that the courts could not substitute one appointed lawyer for another appointed lawyer in any kind of a case without following the policies which the legislature required the Office of Public Defense Services to establish. If this bill, Senate Bill 921, passes and creates a statutory right to appointed counsel in adoption termination situations, we are asking that you include the same language which you included last session with respect to all other substitutions so that it's consistent. Be happy to answer any questions.
Fine, thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 921? Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 921 and open a work session on Senate Bill 921. Council, do we need the dash twos and the dash threes?
That is correct, Chair Ackerman. They are alternative. They are not alternative amendments. You need them both.
All right. I'll need a motion on the dash twos, please.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 921.
Senator Flores moves the dash two amendments to be incorporated within Senate Bill 921. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? That's allowed.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 921.
Representative Flores moves the dash three amendments to be incorporated within Senate Bill 921. Discussion? Objection? That's allowed. Last motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 921 to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that Senate Bill 921 as amended be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion from the committee? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, and if I'd ask someone to see if Representative Girard is outside the door. Call the roll anyway.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Burke?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Excused. Senate Bill 921, as amended, is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with Representative Flores as carrier. And I'll conclude the work session on that bill. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 324A. Call forward Senator Walker. Yes, I have him down too. Mr. Shepherd, please come forward. Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator from District 7. What you have in front of you is Senate Bill 324, and I bet you want your counsel to tell you about it before I do.
Yes, thank you for reminding me. I keep missing that step, and as I said yesterday, I'm going to give counsel a gavel, and I'll just have to switch places. Maybe I'll remember counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 324A prohibits a public body from entering into a settlement or compromise that requires the terms and conditions of a settlement or compromise be confidential unless federal law requires confidentiality, or two, a court orders the terms and conditions of a settlement or compromise be confidential after the court finds in writing that the specific privacy interests of a person under 18 years of age or a victim of sexual abuse outweighs the public interest in knowing the terms and conditions of the settlement.
Thank you, Council. Senator, good to see you this morning.
Yes, good to see you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you're being handed out some material. Please don't be alarmed. I'm not reading from that. And it's really just background material for you because I think the story is compelling, and I don't want to take a half an hour to go into great detail, but enough that you understand why I brought this bill forward. You'll see my floor speech for this bill, and that will give you some more detail. And then attached to that is a story from the Oregonian called Betraying a Fragile Trust. And that was a story published on September 19th and September 20th by Michelle Roberts. And when I read the story, Mr. Chair, I was alarmed, and I was outraged, and I could not believe that our state government would allow this to happen. So let me just sort of go through what happened. During the period of 1989 to 1994, the Oregonian discovered there were several sex abuse cases happening over in Ward 40, which is a treatment ward for young children. And there were a number of cases that were occurring, and we didn't know about them, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And we know about them now, but in 1996, Ms. Mary Kay Gonzalez sued the state of Oregon because she had been sexually abused while she was in state care, and the state ended up settling that matter for $300,000 with Ms. Gonzalez, and then they kicked in an additional $50,000 to keep her quiet about it. The state ended up paying over, it was the largest settlement in state hospital history, it was $584,809 by the time we were done with this case, because the state was obligated to pay her attorney fees. So that cost the taxpayers $584,809. But what is most troubling is that the legislature was not aware of what was happening to Ms. Gonzalez or any of the other children in Ward 40, because I would like to read to you, this is what I will read to you, when the case was settled. Let me go back. In 1991, the Oregon State Hospital adopted new rules for tracking suspected abuse of patients, and the superintendent was to be notified immediately of any allegations, but that new policy was not always followed. And so then Ms. Gonzalez sued in 1996. Records show that hospital staff did not even immediately report what happened to Ms. Gonzalez. And in fact, the superintendent of the state hospital at the time, Stanley Mazur Hart, never contacted the Department of Human Services to investigate until Ms. Gonzalez's attorney threatened to sue. That was more than 2 years after the alleged abuse happened to Ms. Gonzalez. The case went to trial, and several days after the trial began, the Attorney General's office, which was then directed by current Governor Ted Kulongoski, agreed to settle the case. Along with that settlement, as I indicated, was an additional offer of $50,000 to keep everyone quiet. And what I want to read to you is from a transcript that the Oregonian was able to recover from a public file. It was supposed to be in a locked file, in a private file, but sometimes we have justice in small ways, and this transcript ended up in the public file. The transcript shows, and it clearly states, quote, "We made it clear that we were buying confidentiality from the plaintiffs," Assistant Attorney General John McCullough Jr. told the judge. "The real damage to the defendants is hardly calculable. I don't know how to put a dollar sign on the political aspect. What's somebody going to say in the next legislative session about Dr. Mazur Hart and how he runs his ship out there?" I want you to think about that. What's the next legislative session going to say about Dr. Mazur Hart and how he runs his ship out there? Well, as I said on the floor of the Senate when I carried this bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you can bet this legislative assembly would have said a whole lot. This legislative assembly would have required accountability. We would have launched an investigation. We would have done more than pay off a witness hush money so that she would be quiet and we wouldn't know about it. The Oregonian, I will give credit here, the Oregonian again interviewed three Oregon governors during this time. The documented cases of sexual abuse span the administrations of Governors Neil Goldschmidt, Barbara Roberts, and John Kitzhaber. All three said they did not know what was happening on Ward 40. Quote, "That's an issue that should have come straight to the top so we could make sure it stopped," Kitzhaber said. "I don't know why it didn't. Obviously, it should have." Governor Roberts told the Oregonian, "Never did anyone ever talk to me about sex abuse cases at the hospital. Had I known, I would have responded immediately. For me, there would not have been any tolerance." And they're both right. They're both absolutely right. There is no tolerance for that, Mr. Chair, members of this committee. So when I read the story on September 19th, I immediately called Kevin Neely, who all of us know and love, and unfortunately for Kevin, his cell phone number is in my cell phone. So I called him on a Sunday morning at 11 a.m., and I was furious, and I said, "How can this happen?" And he responded that the current administration does not, by practice, enter into these agreements. And so we contacted the AG, and I have Mr. Shepard here to talk to you about what we've done in this bill to make the AG happy because of certain federal laws. I then immediately went to our legislative counsel. Acting legislative counsel now is Mr. Dave Hendricks. He pulled out the statute, and he said, "I wrote this statute. And, Senator, there's a hole big enough in it to drive a truck through." And I said, "Then plug up the hole." So that's what we've done, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We have plugged up the hole so that there are no exceptions in the statute anymore. No government agency or anyone affiliated with any agent, employee, officer of state or local government should keep secrets from the people. And that's what Senate Bill 324 does. And I'd like Mr. Shepard to explain to you what the two exceptions are that we put in the bill that we felt were necessary.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Shepard, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'm here for two purposes. One, for the purpose Senator Walker has described, and two, to convey to you, Attorney General Myers, strong support for the engrossed version of Senate Bill 324. Attorney General Myers' policy has been throughout his administration to strongly discourage any such any consideration of any form of confidentiality agreement associated with any of the public's business that takes place in a litigation forum. And indeed, we've searched through our records. We can't find any indication that any such agreement has been entered into with the support of the Department of Justice during the time Attorney General Myers has been the Attorney General. Sometimes these proposals come forward from the other side in the litigation, and it puts us in the position of objecting to them, which we recently did in a matter. So that's the current practice. Nonetheless, the Attorney General strongly supports this bill for the reason that I described. Sometimes the impetus for these come forward not from the government side, but from the plaintiff side as well. Typically, the government is defending these cases. And so this legislation will narrow, as Senator Walker has described, the existing law. Under existing law, a court may enter an order finding some term or condition of the settlement or indeed the entire settlement, holding that confidential, that is to say, not subject to public disclosure. If the court makes findings that the specific privacy interests of a private individual outweigh the public's interest in the terms of the settlement or compromise. This will narrow that by limiting these conditions under which a court can enter such an order to those in which the term or condition is required to be held confidential by some requirement of federal law, not merely permissible, but a requirement that some aspect of the settlement terms and conditions must be held confidential under federal law. And then the second circumstance is that if the disclosure of the identity, if the settlement documents include a disclosure of the identity of a person who is the victim of sexual abuse or who is under the age of 18 years of age, and the court determines that by specific findings that the privacy interests of the person outweigh the public's interest in that specific term or condition, that is, the identity or conditions that would tend to disclose the identity of that person, then those terms and conditions may be redacted from the document, that is to say, eliminated, and the balance released, which is the mechanism that our public records law generally establishes for the release of public records that contain within them some part that ought to be appropriately held confidential. The remainder of the document is disclosable. So that's how these amendments are intended to operate. Again, the Attorney General strongly supports Engross Senate Bill 324.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. Are there questions from the committee to the panel? Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Walker, it's very encouraging, number one, Mr. Shepherd, to hear that the Attorney General's office supports this and would not be entering into the confidentiality agreements that have led to this. But Senator Walker, you indicate the Attorney General, then, who is our current governor, as well as the Assistant Attorney General, John McCulloch, as reported in the Oregonian article, were aware of and helped create this confidentiality atmosphere. And I just would like you to note for the record that we heard an earlier bill regarding John McCulloch. So,
Mr. Chair and Representative Flores, I did notice that, but I don't think it's the same John McCulloch.
Is it family member, perhaps?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I don't know the family. I'm doubtful. Mr. McCulloch, that is a former member of the Oregon Department of Justice, is a very tall gentleman, and I noticed your earlier witness was not so tall.
Hey, well, that's the criteria.
And Mr. Chair, Representative,
how will you not catch that?
And Representative Flores, I my ears perked up when I heard him testify also, but the John McCulloch Jr. that was an AG at the time, assistant AG, and is quoted in this document. I've spoken to him, and he is an attorney here in town, and he does eminent domain work, so he doesn't practice on the workers' comp field that I know of. So I think we're pretty safe. And then I just will clarify that the Oregonian indicated that they had asked the governor if he had recollection, and if because you indicated that he knew, but let me state what his comment was to the Oregonian. Kulongoski declined repeated requests for interviews but released the following statement. The Oregon Department of Justice annually handles thousands of legal matters, both civil and criminal. As the Attorney General, my role was to oversee the attorneys who represented the state in these legal matters. I have no recollection of the facts or circumstances of this specific legal matter that occurred nearly a decade ago. I don't argue with that statement. That statement is what it is. So I'll just put that into the record for you.
Thank you for clarifying for me.
Thank you, Senator. Are there further questions, Representative Gouhard?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Senator Walker, thank you for pursuing this and bringing it as far as you have so far.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gouhard. And I do want to thank the Oregonian for their diligence on this case. They actually they have done a great job of exposing the problems we have at the state hospital on a broader scale, and also in regards to this. And it's the media that helps us find the stories sometimes that we can't get access to because someone's trying to keep it from us.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was reading in the Oregonian excerpt that you sent along with your testimony that the hospital did not begin conducting background checks on employees until 1991. And then just review the histories of new hires. So are those background checks, are they simple criminal background checks? And don't we require more strenuous background checks of preschool teachers in the state?
I don't have an answer for that, Mr. Chair, Representative Worth. Maybe Mr. Shepherd does.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Worth, I don't know the answer to your question. We can follow up and find out for you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Well, I do happen to know the question. I just want to verify that
that was a softball question.
Well, I just want to verify that. That's pretty amazing that we, you know, a preschool teacher, we require not only a criminal background check, but I think a DHS background check, and we require less of these folks. So I just hope I never have any secrets that you want to go after, Vicki, because you find them. Thanks.
Further questions for the committee? I also want to thank each of you, Mr. Shepherd and Senator Walker. I just think that unless we have transparency in government, we're not going to have good government. And I'm very happy to have Senator Walker bring this to our attention. I'm very, very encouraged about the position of the Attorney General's office on this issue also. So thank you again for your testimony. And with that, unless there's further comments from the committee, close the public hearing.
Before you close the public hearing, I did want to make one statement that I wanted to thank Representative Flores, because we are working on a bill that will be up in her education committee this afternoon about teachers and making sure our children are safe in schools from sex abuse. And so Representative Flores has helped take a lead on this issue as well. And there are several other bills that I've been working on this session so that we can protect Oregonians the way we're expected to. So thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 324A and open a work session on Senate Bill 324A. We have a whole bunch of people raising their hands on this one.
Can we all do it?
Yeah, we can have seven co-carriers. That's okay with me.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 324 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that Senate Bill 324A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Clerk, may call the roll.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gouhard.
Aye.
Representative Worth.
Aye.
Chair Ackerman.
Aye. Senate Bill 324A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, with Representative Flores as the carrier. And that concludes the work session on Senate Bill 324A. Thank you. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 35 and ask counsel to explain the bill. We have one witness, Mr. Edwards, may come forward.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 35 comes to us from the Employment Department. This has to do with the Employment Department's ability to issue a warrant to collect amounts due pursuant to money judgments. Currently, the Employment Department has authority to issue such a warrant for money owed to it, but only when the money comes from either unemployment insurance taxes or benefit overpayments. This would allow the Employment Department to issue such a warrant to collect on judgments through court actions and also by cross-reference statute to collect on amounts by which it could seek a civil action based on misrepresentation to the department by a recipient of benefits.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Edwards. I am the manager of the Central Operations Section of the Tax Section of the Employment Department. Thank you for hearing us this morning. I'll be very brief. Council has described the bill perfectly. What we have is, in 2002, under the advice of the Attorney General's Office, we began pursuing attorney's fees and court costs in civil cases where we've had to go to court to enforce either a subpoena or a bond request. When we get those judgments, our recourse to collect them is, as any other judgment would be, to go back to court again. What we're asking for with this bill is the authority to issue distraint warrants to collect those amounts.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, I thank you for your testimony. Further witnesses on Senate Bill 35? Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 35 and open a work session on Senate Bill 35. Do I have a motion? The Chair will move that the Senate Bill 35 be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative
Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Senate Bill 35 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I will be the carrier. And with that, we'll conclude the work session on Senate Bill 35 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 94A. Council?
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 94A comes to us from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, and the A engrossed version of this bill is the product of a work group that comprised of members of DHS, the Association of Chiefs of Police, the Juvenile Rights Project, and representatives from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. This has to do with the scheme by which reports of child abuse are required to be cross-reported between law enforcement agencies and the Department of Human Services. Currently, the requirement is that all reports of child abuse must be cross-reported between those two agencies immediately upon receipt. What this measure would do is change that system, still requiring every report of abuse to be cross-reported, but it would create a two-tier system as to the timing of the reporting. It would delegate to an advisory committee to set up which types of reports of abuse need to be cross-reported within 24 hours and which types of abuse need to be cross-reported within 10 days of receipt. The impetus for this was really coming from law enforcement. Law enforcement perceived that it was being inundated with immediate reports of abuse and it did not have the ability or resources to effectively triage all of those reports to determine which needed immediate action. So the purpose of this bill is to help that along and create a process by which cross reports will be more efficiently received and more efficiently acted upon. The advisory committee I mentioned that's responsible for making the rules would be comprised of the Department of Human Services. It would be comprised of members of law enforcement, multidisciplinary teams, and there is room for other interested parties as well. There is an emergency clause on the bill, and the bill passed the Senate 28-0 with two excused.
Thank you very much. I have, I think, three witnesses, Ms. Swanson, Chief Tardif, and is it Julie McFarlow or McFarland? Three folks want to come forward, please. I don't know, I can't tell who's for or against the bill, but we'll have the proponents go first, whomever you are.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 94A. I have passed out some testimony, but just briefly would like to say that we worked with law enforcement on the legislative concept and later worked with the work group that was mentioned earlier to revise the concept. We believe that the ability to prioritize in administrative rule those reports that require immediate attention and those that have some ability for us to wait would assist both law enforcement and the Department of Human Services in better identifying and meeting the needs of immediate child safety issues. And again, we support Senate Bill 94A. We believe it will improve our system to support child safety, and I'm available to the committee for questions if there are any. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Tardif. I'm the police chief in Newburgh and chaired the Systems Entry Subcommittee of the Governor's Criminal Justice Systems Task Force. As you heard, it was out of that group that, and actually out of a survey of chiefs and sheriffs in Oregon, that the need for this legislation was identified, and we worked with VHS and other interested parties to identify the language that's before you today, and we believe that this change will enhance law enforcement's ability to more rapidly identify and respond to those child abuse reports that present a child safety, a critical child safety need. And so we'd ask your support.
Thank you, Chief. Next witness.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. We had some objections to the initial version of Senate Bill 94 because it actually eliminated the cross-reporting requirement, which is a very important safeguard for children who are subject of child abuse. We appreciate that the proponents of the bill were willing to work with us and to come up with the ingress version of the bill, which restores the cross-reporting requirement. I think the original language in the law, which specified that reports be made immediately, was not particularly useful and didn't provide sufficient guidance to law enforcement and DHS about exactly when reports should be made to each agency, and that the rules that are proposed by the legislation will provide much better guidance, allowing for prioritization and quicker response when that's appropriate. So I think our concerns have been addressed. We continue to believe that the role of law enforcement in the investigation of child abuse is very important. That has been a trend to increase that role in our state and nationally for some time now, and we hope that this bill will deliver the message that we still, this legislature still expects law enforcement to be involved in these cases.
Fine. Thank you all for your testimony. Are there any questions from the committee, Representative Gerard?
Just one real quick one. I'm curious that if there's a misjudgment made on whether to report to law enforcement or not, and something happens to a child, who has the responsibility for making that decision? Who will have to stand up, so to speak, and say why they did this or didn't do that?
Chair Ackerman, Representative, I believe the question is if there is an error in not reporting. This legislation or this concept continues to require cross-reporting. What it allows us to do is to prioritize the time frame in which we cross-report.
No, I understand that, ma'am. Follow?
Okay.
What I'm asking is if there's a misjudgment in the time period of reporting, does DHS take the responsibility for the error, or will it be passed on to law enforcement?
Representative Ackerman and Representative, if the bill itself requires it's the law enforcement cross-reporting to DHS, DHS cross-reporting to law enforcement, I believe in the situation where it is DHS that has made a decision about a time frame that in the end did not meet the need of the child who was at some risk, it would be certainly DHS's responsibility, and I assume on the other end, if it were law enforcement who made the decision, I think our goal is certainly to work together to see that those errors don't occur.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Council indicated that the need for this legislation was basically a better way to respond to the sheer number of child abuse reports that are being received by law enforcement DHS within a county. Can you give me an idea of just how many incidents of child abuse we are receiving on a daily basis or a monthly basis?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth, in the last year, the last 2004, the Department of Human Services received 46,000 reports of child abuse. Not all of those reports of child abuse required a face-to-face contact, but all of those reports of child abuse required a cross-report.
Hold up, Mr. Chair.
You may.
And I think I have not looked up the latest report that I've received from your office, but are they're pretty much all over the state. They're not really, you know, highly concentrated, obviously, in the population centers, but it's pretty much a widespread problem across the state, isn't it? Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This requires reporting within 24 hours of certain types of child abuse and within 10 days of certain other types of reports of child abuse. Can you give me some example of criteria that would determine something that was immediate in 24 hours or something that could be deferred for 10 days?
Well, the obviously any issue that dealt with the safety of a child, immediate safety of a child, would be included in those 24-hour sexual abuse, those types, involving crimes. We'd certainly need to have those immediately, and those would be identified in the OARs as immediate cross-reporting. Issues, as was mentioned, there are some reports that come in that do not necessarily deal with a crime. They could involve someone feeling that a child's not seeing the dentist as often as they might or something like that. And those types of reports could come across within the 10-day time period. Currently, the biggest problem for law enforcement is they all come across together and generally in a fax, a stack of faxed reports near the end of the day. And so, we're faced with detectives preparing to go home and trying to work through there to see if there was something in there that is something that really deals with the safety of a child that needs immediate action.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Representative Berard.
Could you tell me what cross-reporting is? Is it just passing two reports passing each other, or is it actually one department, law enforcement, talking to DHS?
It's both. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, members of committee. It involves both. It involves the cross-reporting. Everything is cross-reporting reports, but certainly on those that are involved child safety, there's generally a contact of law enforcement DHS representatives.
Thank you. Thank you. Further questions? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that the highest percentage, I think actually the majority of the child abuse reports are classified as threat of harm. And I think I read an audit report saying that we needed to tighten up that definition. So I'm wondering how you're going to, if that's the majority of the child abuse reports, I imagine then this two-tier system is going to get into that, definition of threat of harm, and how are we going to, classify within that that category which are 10 days or which are 24-hour?
Chair Ackerman and Representative Worth, it's correct that the category of threat of harm is a category that's not well understood, and we continue to work on clarifying that. We use the threat of harm category when we make dispositional findings, which is at the end of the process and not at the beginning. It continues to be an area of confusion. As a screener receives a call, what they are determining is whether there is a threat to the safety of the child, and is that threat an immediate threat? Does the perpetrator have direct access and the child has disclosed sex abuse? Has the child disclosed physical abuse and the child currently has an injury? So in the screening process, we're really trying to determine what is the nature of the abuse that's being reported and what is the current threat to the child's safety. Those terms tend to be confused, and we continue to work with both the community and with our staff to clarify those. The threat of harm category is a statutory category of abuse. Thank you.
If I could respond to that as well.
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth. It has been a criticism that my office, the Juvenile Rights Project, has raised of the statutory scheme for child abuse reporting and the definitions of child abuse, that they are outdated, that they are inconsistent with the jurisdictional provisions of the Juvenile Code, that they're supposed to work in harmony with, and that the preferred, when you look around the country at other states, the preferred method is to have much more descriptive definitions of abuse. We are making a proposal to the Oregon Law Commission to take a look at those issues during the interim, and we're hopeful that they will accept that and establish a work group to work on it. It's a pretty complex series of legal issues, but I think it's an important piece of work, and I'm hopeful the commission will take it on.
That's good to know.
Fine. Thank you. Further questions, Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question as a comment, and I guess what's percolating inside is just some recent information that I had regarding Department of Human Services as well as a law enforcement entity in Washington County. And the parents of a meth addicted daughter were trying to intervene with their daughter's daughter, their grandchild. And at 3 days old, they made the call to the appropriate agency. And there were some preliminary investigations made, and they said they were not significant or immediate threat of harm. And at 3 months, that child is dead. And so who failed the child? That's my concern.
Thank you, Representative. Further comments, questions? Thank you very, very much for your testimony. At this time, I'll conclude the public hearing on Senate Bill 94A and open a work session on Senate Bill 94A.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Worth.
I would move Senate Bill 94A be moved to this full committee with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Representative Worth moves that Senate Bill 94A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections? Let me call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Ferrard?
Aye.
Representative
Flores?
Aye.
Chair
Ackerman? Aye. Senate Bill 94A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Worth will be the carrier. I'll conclude the work session on Senate Bill 94A. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 106A. Council.
Thank you, Chair. And members of the committee, Senate Bill 106A comes to us from the Governor's Office, and this is a result of a work group regarding elder abuse that was under the direction of Deputy Attorney General Pete Shepard. This measure is a very comprehensive measure. It does several different things. I'm just going to summarize the high points. First, It amends the statute regarding mandatory reporting of abuse to include firefighters and emergency medical technicians within the definition of private and public officials that are required to make mandatory reports of abuse of elderly or disabled people. It also redefines the meaning of abuse within that same statute to include the wrongful taking or appropriation of money and to include non-consenting sexual contact of elderly persons or persons with disabilities. It also addresses the existing statutes relating to restraining orders that can be obtained by elderly individuals or disabled individuals or their surrogates. It establishes rules limiting the transfer or passage of property from an elderly or incapacitated person to individuals who are responsible for their either physical or financial abuse. There are currently rules regarding limitations on intestate succession with respect to the slayer of an elderly individual, and this expands those categories to either the slayer of or the abuser of an elderly individual or an individual with disabilities. Then there are several amendments before you as well. The Dash 3 amendment is primarily coming to you from the Oregon Judicial Department, and the topic that this clarifies is the restraining order, the elderly abuse restraining order, and it really tightens the language in this measure to clarify that the relief that the court could grant as a result of the restraining order can be brought, the restraining order itself, rather, can be brought by either the elderly or disabled person or the guardian petitioner who may act on behalf of the elderly or disabled person. And then finally, there is a Dash 5 amendment that is brought to us from the long-term care facility group, which would require state agencies to, this does several things. They all have to do with individuals, elderly individuals, who are required to report as sex offenders. It would require state agencies to notify long-term care facilities if the agency knows that a person is a predatory sex offender. It would require a person who's seeking admission to a long-term care facility to notify the facility of a person's status as a sex offender. And it implements changes that would permit the facility to refuse admission to such a person or permit the facility to transfer or discharge such a person pursuant to rules established by the Department of Human Services. I should note that this section, the Dash 5 amendment, is slightly different from the rest of the bill in that it does not go into effect until January 6th of 2006. The entirety of the rest of the bill has an emergency clause and goes into effect upon passage.
Thank you, counsel. I have three witnesses, Pete Shepard, Jim Carlson, and Bertrand Koop, or Kopp. Please come forward. And while you're becoming assembled, let me just ask a question of counsel, because I believe on the elder abuse piece, where the person who abuses a decedent may not inherit, Representative Hass had a similar bill that passed the House and is in the Senate. Do we have a duplication here, and how do we work that out?
Chair Ackerman, I've reviewed that bill as it came over to the Senate side on behalf of Chair Burdick. We have had a public hearing on that bill in the Senate Judiciary. I do believe that there is a duplication. I don't have it in front of me, but my recollection is that Representative Haas's bill that deals with this issue is wholly covered by Senate Bill 106 that is before you now. So if we do pass this bill, what I would do is go through the conflict check procedure, and I think it is legislative counsel would determine if there's a duplication or not.
And if there is duplication and both bills pass, what happens?
You've reached the limit of my experience and knowledge as a new counsel. Then I asked Bill Taylor or Patsy Wood to tell me what to do.
All right. I wanted to preserve Representative Hass's authorship of the earlier bill, and you know, that would be my, and you know, just personal preference that proceeds to the Senate. But if this is going to be right behind it, I don't know how the timing is going to work. I guess we don't know. Do you have any idea whether that his bill will be given a recent work session in the Senate?
My recollection is that it had a public hearing, and I don't believe that it moved to work session. But I'm happy, I can double-check that for you while the testimony is proceeding.
Okay, that'll be fine.
Sure.
Thank you, counsel. Sorry for the delay, but I want to understand what the roadmap says, because we haven't been here before, or I haven't. You may proceed in any order you wish.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'll take the liberty of beginning first. Just for your record, I think the House bill you've been discussing is House Bill 2415. And so just so your committee's discussion is clear, that's the bill. And there is a process for adjusting any variation in the language, and it's not difficult. So, Mr. Chair, let me first begin by giving credit where credit is due. Your counsel aptly summarized the substance of the bill. In one respect only, however, his description was not totally accurate. Attorney General Hardy Myers does support the bill and has been involved in advocacy for it. But I should give credit where credit is due. Governor Kulongoski convened a elder abuse task force during the interim to examine an array of issues involving elder abuse. This concept actually arises out of Governor Kulongoski's elder abuse task force. The governor had, when he was attorney general, been a leader in establishing an attorney general's task force on elder abuse, which Attorney General Myers has continued and will continue. But this particular concept arose actually out of the work of Governor Kulongoski's elder abuse task force, of which I was privileged to be a member. I want to give credit to the governor for that bill. Your counsel has aptly summarized the three substantive areas. First, the amendment to the part of existing law that permits an elderly person or a person with disabilities to obtain a restraining order to stop physical abuse. The bill, the problem with the current law is that that relief does not extend to financial and sexual assault unless it is also manifest in some form of physical abuse. Financial abuse of the elderly is a very significant problem. The governor's task force found that to be the case, and so has the Attorney General's task force on elder abuse. In 2003, the Department of Human Services Adult Protective Services Unit investigated roughly 1,800 cases of alleged financial abuse. Sexual abuse of the elderly is less common, but unfortunately does also occur. And again, the way the bill addresses these is to expand the authority for these self-help restraining orders to include those forms of abuse. Second, current law requires certain persons to report elder abuse to law enforcement. Mandatory reporters enjoy a form of immunity from lawsuits for making the reports, even if it turns out that the report was reasonably mistaken. And what this bill does as a functional matter is extend that immunity to firefighters and the EMTs, who often are the very first observers of elder abuse. Under current law, they are not mandatory reporters, even though as a practical matter they frequently report. And so the effect of including them as mandatory reporters functionally in the real world is not necessarily to enlarge the number of reports that will come forward, but to give these reporters the benefit of the protections that are now accorded to other mandatory reporters. And so the bill does that as the second thing. The third thing that it does is that the very element you've just been discussing with your counsel changes the rule so that the same rule that now bars a murderer from recovering by intestate succession from his or her victim would be expanded under the bill to include prohibition against a person who commits and is convicted of sexual abuse, or rather of elder abuse, from taking by intestate succession from his or her victim. Both the -A3 and -A5 amendments would be necessary for the committee, in our view, to consider both of those in order to have the complete package. They are non-overlapping packages. They represent different policy choices for the committee. The -A3 amendments are supported by the Oregon Judicial Department, and I have the rare pleasure of being able to speak for the Judicial Department today, and I've been authorized to tell the committee that the Judicial Department does in fact support the amendments. Marion County Circuit Judge Claudia Burton has helped the Judicial Department reach its position on these and has submitted to you written testimony, and Belisa Sidlick has submitted written testimony as well for the Judicial Department. They support the Dash A3 amendments, and so does the Attorney General. The Dash A5 amendments, I think Mr. Carlson is here to describe those. We've reviewed those, and from an elder abuse standpoint, the issue here is that we have persons who've been convicted of forms of sexual assault who are being placed in facilities in which there are other elders who are potentially vulnerable, and not incidentally also, of course, kids visiting those facilities. So from an elder abuse standpoint, that's the reason the Attorney General supports the idea that's embedded in those amendments. I would leave to others the balancing issues and the policy questions about the effect on placements and the availability of placements, and I think Mr. Carlson is prepared to address that, because probably the only thing worse than having the elder, the convicted sex offender elder being in a room unbeknownst to anyone next to a potential victim would be creating a system in which that person had no place to go at all upon discharge from a prison facility. And I think folks are prepared to address that issue for the committee. Lastly, as to the politics, the Dash, the printed bill and everything up through the all of the concepts and all of the amendments have been widely circulated amongst all the members of the Attorney General's Elder Abuse Task Force, which is a very broad array of interests, and also amongst the members of the now dissolved Governor's Task Force on Elder Abuse. And I'm not aware of any opposition to any of the amendments you had to consider, nor to the bill.
Thank you. Further testimony?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bertrand Kopp. I'm a senior advocate and very much interested in this legislation. However, I prepared an amendment which doesn't seem to be here. I have a handout which more or less describes that, if someone would deliver that. My particular concern is fraudulent entrapment by guardianship. According to AARP, 50% of guardianships that are granted are fraudulent entrapment and exploitation. Having seen this personally myself, I can see the way it's done. Opportunism in civil law courts is not under the same check as in criminal law courts. For instance, there is no attorney representing the defendant, and you're expecting an older person, maybe rolled in there in a wheelchair. They only want to live the rest of their life in peace and quiet. Expect them somehow to defend themselves against a well-polished attorney appearing for somebody else who wants to seize control of them. No happen. For this reason, I prepared this amendment to strike Section 8, which appears on page 3, because when these kind of things become aware, people become aware of these kind of things, there needs to be something they can do immediately to stop this kind of stuff. I believe I heard the figure of 18,000 in Oregon here, guardianships. If the figures are correct by AARP, that means 9,000 people. That's terrible. And we cannot cut off the only safety valve that's available to them here. If you grant the provision of self-defense and free speech to somebody on death row, why can't we give it to our seniors? This is why I'm asking. This particular section in this bill, it does not fit the title or the enabling clause. It's sort of an addition. And I would ask the committee to strike Section 8 and to go on to Amendment A3 and strike B, because for the same reason. I think even one of you plans to getting old someday, and you can become effectively trapped in your old age if somebody decides you're worth more money dead than alive, and you're not be in a position to defend yourself unless you happen to have a friend. One of my friends told me a case in which her stepmother was in danger of being stripped of her money at the end of her life by these two sons, which had already stripped their grandmother of her money at the end of her life. And the process was already underway. They had already filed for guardianship. Well, I pointed out to them, the only thing you can do now is attack with chainsaws, bulldozers, and sledgehammers. They found a lawyer, which was cut with the right kind of metal, and they stopped the guardianship based on those two kids' previous entrapment of their grandmother. So this lady got to spend the rest of her life in enjoyment with her life savings to support her, and the two sons didn't get anything out of that particular maneuver. But we have to leave this kind of a safety valve open. Otherwise, when somebody appears in one of these hearings for guardianship, it's all rubber stamped. And the judge is making a job for himself, so he very seldom ever turns one down. And I had a conversation with Judge Rita Cobb in Portland, who said if you put in the guardianship clause that the person is not to be put into a home without permission, they solemnly agree to that provision. As soon as the order is signed, they throw them into a home and leave them there to die. Very common thing to have happen. Happened to my own mother. That's why I'm here today. This has to be stopped. And so this clause 8, preventing somebody from defending themselves, does not belong in this bill, and I ask you to strike it here in the committee. And also be on the last page, page 23 of the amendment A3. Just so that we have a means of rescuing people that are under attack for their life savings.
Thank you. And I think what I'll do is have Mr. Carlson speak, and then I'd like to come back and address your question. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. As Mr. Shepard mentioned earlier, we've got some Dash 5 amendments that are before the subcommittee this morning to address the issue of notice as well as discharge criteria, transfer and discharge criteria for a dangerous sex offender in terms of on either admission to a long-term care facility or for transfer discharge if they were admitted without prior notice. We've got a situation right now that fortunately is fairly rare, but we have had incidents and situations where we have had individuals who were dangerous offenders who were admitted to facilities where they reoffended again. For the most part, this has been, as I indicated, a very rare occurrence, but this is something that we are trying to address proactively. This is an issue that was first brought up by the task force during their work during the course of the past year, but this was not initially included in the recommendations of the task force because, quite frankly, we had not had a chance yet at that point in time to really kind of run the trap line, so to speak, with Department of Human Services, corrections, community corrections, advocates, and others who are concerned about this. We started working with the governor's staff last fall and have worked extensively now with the Department of Justice, the Department of Human Services, governor's office, corrections, local law enforcement, advocates, long-term care ombudsman, and others to get the language in front of you today that's reflected in the Dash 5 amendments. We urge your support for these, and I'd be happy to address any questions you have. What we've tried to do here is strike a measured response to this issue, where we are taking into concern and consideration the needs that may be there for aging offenders who may need to enter the system, as well as to make sure that we do allow for determinations to be made, fitness determinations, if you will, if somebody poses a risk or does not pose a risk to the other residents or patients in long-term care facilities. So with that, I'll stop and be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Shepard, can you answer Mr. Kopp's question about sub 8 on line 32 of page 3?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to help the committee understand the issue here. Basically, what sub 8 on page 3, that would be lines 32 through 34, does, along with the Dash A3 amendments, they deal with what I'll call the intersection between the existing procedures for guardians and conservators, separate pre-existing independent statutory structures that deal with situations, including ones as though that Mr. Cobb has described. And those are judicially supervised procedures. The amendments on that this bill would work, that the Angros bill would work at lines 32 to 34 on page 3, and also the dash 3 amendments, those amendments deal with circumstances in which a person is seeking a self-help restraining order from the court. And these self-help restraining orders, again, are things that they're designed to be straightforward, non-lawyer intensive, rapid, easily accessible tools in which a judge does make a determination about the issuance of the order, but it is not with the formality and the process that's associated with the appointment of a guardian or conservator. So what the policy choice that's reflected in these, in the printed bill and in the Dash A3 amendments is to strictly separate those procedures so that it will not be possible, if you choose to adopt the A3 amendments and to carry forward with the printed portion of the bill, it would not be possible, for example, for an individual to come forward, seek a restraining order that restrains his or her guardian from doing something with his or her property. Let's suppose a situation in which a person had a guardian already appointed by a court, and that person objected to some choice that the guardian was going to make or proposed to make with respect to disposition of that person's property, for instance, to sell assets of that person, or a conservator to sell assets of that person. If that person objected and you didn't have lines 32 to 34 on page 3, it's possible that a court could enter a restraining order that purporting to restrain the guardian from doing that which the guardian believed was necessary as part of the guardian's appointment. And so in order to avoid that conflict between the self-help relatively efficient remedy of the restraining order structure and the separate process of guardians and conservators, that these divisions are made. Mr. Cobb has correctly described the effect of these amendments in as much as it would not permit an individual who thought that he or she was being wronged by his or her guardian or conservator to use the restraining order process provided in existing law to remedy that. That person would in fact be directed back by these amendments into the guardian or conservatorship proceeding itself, where the judicial process and the process involved in those proceedings would govern, and decisions would be made about the modification to the terms of the appointment or not, as the case may be. So that's the policy choice that's reflected here. From the Attorney General's standpoint, we're comfortable with this policy choice, even though we do agree that there are circumstances in which guardians or conservators have themselves been the perpetrators of financial abuse directed to their charges. We have seen a few of those cases in our department, and we've tried to deal with those as consumer protection cases under the existing law, because frequently these guardians or conservators receive a fee, and so we've tried to shoehorn those into the unfair, the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and so there is an issue with the abuse of their charges by guardians and conservators. I think the policy question, and the reason we're comfortable with proceeding in the bill as drafted, is that really raises larger questions about the supervision of guardians and conservators than simply leaving it open to the self-help remedies would address. And so that's why we're comfortable with the printed bill and the Dash A3 amendments.
Thank you for your testimony. Other questions? Representative Garrard?
Yeah, for Mr. Craven, your Dash 5s do not address the question that Mr. Cobb brought up, though, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, no, the Dash 5 address a very narrow issue, just specifically around admission of registered sex offenders to long-term care facilities and or discharge process.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Craven, what problem would be created if we continued with the remedies that are available under ORS 124.05 through 040, that is the relatively less formal self-help mechanism, if we left that available as a remedy for someone who has a guardian appointed, in addition to the remedies that are available under that court-supervised process?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I think I'll probably respond. Mr. Carlson, I think it's probably out of his bailiwick, and his A5 amendments don't affect that issue. Here's the problem as it's been expressed to us by trial judges who deal with conservators and guardians, and I know that a representative of the Judicial Department is here too, and maybe can give you more information. But the gist of it is that in many courts we have a judge or judges whose responsibility it is to deal with guardian and conservator proceedings. Those are ongoing. The court has, as I understand it, continuing authority to exercise control over the performance of the people whom they've appointed to take care of those charges. In a separate department, along comes a person whose assets are subject to the court order issued by another department of the court. The statute sets out the forms, some of those are reprinted here in the bill, that a person fills out, and so the person fills those out, provided those forms by the clerk of the court, fills them out and submits them, and then that's really all that the judge who considers the restraining order has to consider. So the first problem is a workability problem, coordinating the two sets of forums. The second problem is that one can imagine, without a lot of difficulty, a conservatorship or a guardianship which exists precisely for the reason that the person whose assets are being protected cannot exercise the judgment necessary to make good decisions about his or her own resources. Imagining such a case, one could imagine that person, if they had access to the self-help restraining order, coming in and obtaining an order from trial judge A, or perhaps even from another county, that purports to restrain the court-appointed guardian or conservator in the exercise of the court-appointed guardian or conservator's exercise of their authority under another court's direction. That's what's sought to be avoided here in eliminating that as a remedy under this act.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, what about the situation, and I've seen this happen many times, where a guardianship or conservatorship will be initiated and established with legal counsel. The legal counsel, for whatever reason, withdraws from the case, leaving the conservator and the guardian without any supervising or authority. And those are the cases, it seems to me, where the most financial abuse or physical abuse, whatever it is, could occur because there's no longer a lawyer for the ward or the protected person to relate to. Why not, in those circumstances, should not the protected person be able to obtain essentially a self-help restraining order and get a hearing rather than trying to find legal counsel, which they'd have a difficult time doing?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a fair element in the policy discussion. I would say that our experience in the Department of Justice in observing financial abuse cases is that while we do have guardians and conservators who have been the perpetrators, that is the unusual case. The majority of financial abuse, for example, is committed by a family member, not by a guardian or a conservator. And so really it comes down to kind of a balancing question. I think there probably are cases that you hypothesize, Mr. Chair, in which access to the self-help remedy would be valuable. The question is whether those are numerous enough and significant enough to make worth the cost, potential cost of these conflicting systems. And we've made the judgment, at least for this session, that we would not, we from the Department of Justice at least, we support going forward with the printed bill and the -A3 amendments. We've told the Judicial Department that we are going to look closely at the guardian-conservator question, and that if in fact we find a lot of cases of the character that you describe still occurring, that we really need to take a closer look at that. Whether that's done as part of the restraining order process or not is, I think, a separate question.
All right, thank you. Further questions, Representative Flores? And before that, I'm going to have to make an executive decision. That's almost 11 o'clock, and it's apparent to me we'll not be able to proceed with the remaining bills this morning unless the committee wants to hold over. But I just don't think we can do it with session starting in less than 5 minutes. And I know courtesy is usually take really, 45 minutes, but I think some of us would like to be on the House floor as soon as we can. So we may either have to continue the discussion later or take this to 11 o'clock. Representative?
My comment is in response to Mr. Shepherd, and perhaps even a question in here, and that is you indicate that the problems you have are modest or of a significantly low number. Guardians and conservators are not the problem, but oftentimes family members. But Mr. Shepherd, oftentimes family members are appointed guardians and conservators, and therein lies a problem. And I have had numbers of examples in 18 and a half years of experience dealing with guardians and conservatorships where they do arise by virtue of family members in that appointed position for protected persons.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I don't dispute the premise that there are guardians and conservators who have themselves been perpetrators of financial abuse. No question that that's the case.
My comment is I'm still concerned about that component. I'm supporting of the bill and the amendments, and I'm just concerned about not allowing the opportunity for someone who may have their wits about them yet and be in need of help.
No, I think your point, Representative, is well taken. Most guardianships and conservatorships that I have been involved in, and it's not my major line of practice, almost invariably it was a family member. It was the guardian or was the conservator.
Yeah.
Almost invariably.
Mr. Chair, may I speak?
I don't want to interrupt you. I need to get some direction from the committee. And I'll get to you in just a moment. Is there any other input we should have from state agencies or other persons on this particular issue, and we could continue the public hearing because we're going to run out of time?
Actually, it's just one question I wanted to ask of Mr. Craig.
Okay, I have fingers being pointed, so let us stay here for a moment. Let's just resolve whether we need more testimony on this. Representative McPherson.
Yeah, this is a question for Mr. Craven, and it's on the Dash 5 amendments that Mr. Carlson has brought forward. That applies certain reporting obligations on state agencies to the healthcare facilities. It's quite understandable that they need to have information about who, when they have predatory sex offenders. Has whatever burden is associated with that reporting obligation been considered fully enough that you feel that the state's interests are being looked after?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, we worked with the proponents of the Dash 5 amendments and with the Department of Human Services, Adult Protective Services Unit, to look at that very question. In earlier drafts, the language included expressions such as has reason to know that the person is a sexual offender and so forth, and our suggested amendments have been adopted in the Dash 5s. Now that is constrained to actual knowledge.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I got some audience response when I said, are there other agencies or persons we should talk to? And we're not going to be able to take any testimony today, but if you could identify yourselves and say, if you want to participate, I can continue the public hearing. I'm just not going to have time. It's 11 o'clock. We have to be on the floor.
Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee, I'm Melissa Seidlick, family law senior policy analyst at the Oregon Judicial Department. And the Dash 3 amendments do come from the Judicial Department. And I would address my comments to those as well as Mr. Cobb's concerns.
Okay. I don't think we're going to have enough time today. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? I think what I'm inclined to do so we can resolve this issue is continue the public hearing with, again, a possible work session, and we'll have testimony on this particular issue and the issues that you want to raise.
I could be very brief, Chair.
Okay. I think we better come back.
Okay.
I'm getting some bad vibes from people. Okay. Conclude the public hearing today, but we'll be reset for a continuation of the public hearing and possible work session at our next meeting. Any objection to that? Okay, that's allowed. Thank you for being here. I apologize to the rest of you. This is the first time we've really run over, but we had some substantial testimony today we didn't expect, and we'll get your hearings and work sessions set at the earliest convenience. Further business of the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.